Ocean FM.
Ours to Protect, brought to you by Ocean FM, the IBA, and funded by Commission Le Mans with the television license fee. Check out ourstoprotect.ie for more information.
Thanks for tuning in today as we open our second programme in this new series of Ours to Protect. I hope that you heard last month's episode where we tried to map out a few options for sustainable travel in the Northwest. And if so, you'll know that this series of Ours to Protect is tuning into the voices of young people across the Northwest and following their lead when it comes to zoning in on issues relating to climate change, environment and biodiversity. So, what have they put on the agenda for us today?
That's biodiversity.
It means like there's like different like habitats in like the nature.
Well, it's a more diverse environment where there's different plants and animals. It's just like humans, we have to be diverse, otherwise it just wouldn't be a great place to live.
It's very calming and it helps you get away from everything.
Definitely see nature and like understand a little bit more, mm-hmm. because then they'll understand what they do. Maybe it will affect the animals as well.
But I think that's a pretty clear-cut invitation. So today we're going out into the natural world and investigating the richness of some of our native species and habitats to see how they interact with each other and with us humans. Following the tone set by those students, I'm aiming for a diverse range of speakers and topics on the programme today, including Michael Bell and Dr. Adam Smith on citizen science and biodiversity recording, Jeremy Turkington and Finn Flood from the Home Tree Charity on the power of nature to bring communities together and the fantastic capacity of trees to regenerate and protect us. We'll visit the vibrant Ishka All-In event on the banks of the Garavogue to talk to ecologist Piero Kochsis and hear about a cycle with a difference at Hazelwood.
We have four bingos.
We found daffodils, trees of ivy, rocks, lichen, birds, overgrown grass, daisies, fallen leaves, lawn, humans.
We found
tree
moss.
Tree damaged by a storm, nut seeds or pine cones, dead
spring
hedge,
flowers, feathers,
covered night in
bugs,
ivy,
under
moss,
rocks.
Bird song.
We found all of those things in the middle of town.
If there's green area then.
Because there's lots of green. So
okay, and what was the favourite thing that you saw?
Probably the tree damaged by the storm. So we were scavenging for different daffodils, butterflies.
We're the ones at the end of the day, we're going to be taking this world and we're going to be doing all this stuff. So we need to learn about more of this instead of just like, you know, not doing
instead
anything. Because if we don't take care of this world, you know,
we won't be able to
live on this, like, you know.
And do you think that you're ready to do that? Do you think you're capable of doing it?
I say, yeah, but as long as you put your mind to it, I think anything's possible.
Those children from Templeboy National School were participating in what's called a bio blitz on the grounds of the Clarion Hotel in the centre of Sligo Town. The idea is that they try to identify as many different species as they can in that one area. As they very shrewdly pointed out, it is a green area in the centre of town, and so it's full of life. Now, what really works for increasing biodiversity is actually creating physical linkages between areas like that. And one thing that we're increasingly valuing here in Ireland for its capacity to boost that kind of biodiversity are our hedgerows.
There's 760,000 kilometres of hedgerow in Ireland. That's enough to reach to the moon and back. And it's an essential wildlife corridor, kind of highway for small mammals, insects, to connect and to travel between larger woodlands. So everything is part of that patchwork, and you can't look at it, at any of it, in isolation.
That was Finian Flood of the Home Tree Charity, which is based in County Clare, and he was speaking at a community day in Cleaverow Woods, where people were gathering together to consider options for the woodland there and for work on a new community orchard. And we're going to hear more from there later on.
You're never going to protect something you don't love, and you're never going to love something you don't have a relationship with. So it really just starts by building a relationship with the land around you, and everyone does that in different ways. Like, it could be falling asleep under a tree in the sun, it could be getting really into plant identification, or it could be growing your own native trees and planting them on in the local watershed. So it's by showing the community the kind of length and breadth of all the different ways you can interact with the land around you, and then letting them find the way that suits them, And I think there'll be kind of a natural intelligence there that what the land around them needs, that people will fill those gaps if they are in close enough connection with the land.
Biodiversity Week, which saw events happening across rivers, shorelines and forests in May, offered a really great way to encourage people to get out there and enjoy that kind of connection. At Hazelwood, a biodiversity-focused cycle saw an enthusiastic group revel in those beautiful surroundings. Joan Swift of the Sligo Cycling Campaign was good enough to fill me in on all that went on there.
The interesting thing about this cycle, one of the most interesting things, was that almost everybody thought that they knew Hazelwood. And some people had lived in Sligo all their lives, and other people maybe were newcomers. But, oh yes, I've been to Hazelwood, I know Half Moon Bay, and I walked as far as the jetty and so on. But in fact, most of us didn't know the new part of Hazelwood. We were met by Beatrice MacDonald, who has been long associated with the Hazelwood Heritage Group, and she and her husband Tam were our guides. So they took us on a walk through the new part that Caoilte have been working on for the past 5 years, and it was just extraordinarily interesting. They were super guides. We walked on what Beatrice and Tam called, you know, the bog walk. And if somebody mentioned Hazelwood to you, you wouldn't associate it with bog. You might think of the lake and the trees and so on. But this was the older part, and the native trees would have been things like alder that actually apparently grow quite well in watery conditions. And it had been completely overrun with rhododendron in particular. So Beatrice showed us the various places where you could see where it had been treated over the last number of years, and hopefully give a chance to other species to grow. There was one tiny little oak, hardly, not even a sapling, just a tiny little plant. You just sort of, I wonder now, you know, will that have room to grow? And there was something maybe extra about kind of arriving by bike, in the sense that you arrived at maybe, you know, a slower pace, and if you like, you got into the zone. You didn't just kind of zoom up and park your car and then, you know, head off for the walk. And there's a nice camaraderie in cycling with the group.
Now, any of you that have been to Hazelwood over the last few years must have noticed the very intensive work that's been going on to remove the invasive rhododendron that had come to dominate that woodland. This plant and its cousin, the cherry laurel, are good examples of the invasive species that are a major problem for biodiversity. In comparison to our lovely native trees, which encourage all kinds of growth on the forest floor, under the canopy, and even on their barks, and which support hosts of insects and birds, rhododendron prevents anything from growing beneath its dense shade, starving seedlings, insects and animals of the essentials that they need to survive. And because it's toxic, even plant-eating animals can't be used to keep it under control. The work at Hazelwood is exceptionally difficult and time-consuming, but it's providing an example for other areas across the country that are facing the same problem. Joan gave us an idea of the scale of the task that they're taking on.
It's quite a long process, and Beatrice said that the men worked so hard. Really, it's a question of hacking, and then all of that has to be mulched and so on. And you can't just throw Roundup on it, because you're talking about a very protected area and the water and the risk of pollution and so on. So almost every stem then is being just treated individually rather than any kind of a mass extermination. So it's quite a slow and an expensive process, and it's a huge credit to Brian McGarry and to Caoilte. They won an award for this year for the restoration of the biodiversity, and it was lovely to see then some. There were clumps of Scots pine, for example, you know, which is a native species, and something that I didn't know about and that Beatrice pointed out, a bird cherry, and there was the web of the ermine moth. There were several, but there was one in particular that she pointed out. And, you know, we saw irises. There was just so many different things that we didn't know about. And, I mean, obviously, it'll take some years now for the new species to develop, if you like. It's not going to be something that happens overnight, but in the meantime, because of the various paths and so on, it's possible to go on a really lovely walk. And Beatrice and Tam were able to link in the biodiversity with the history of Hazelwood House as well, and the work that the Wynns had done in the past, and then the work that the people who own the distillery are doing now. Yeah, something else that was lovely was we were really fortunate with the weather. It was just a beautiful summer May evening, and the birdsong was absolutely beautiful. And again, of course, that's an aspect, if you like, of biodiversity. And they were telling us about the Merlin app, and how if we use that and we could identify the various birds.
Joan Swift mentioned the Merlin app there, and that can be really easily downloaded onto a mobile phone. It's opened with a tap, and once it's open, it identifies any birds that it can pick up in the surrounding area. It's a really great way for ordinary Joe Soaps like us to tune into nature and maybe even to learn a bit more too. Now, that's all very well in itself, but if you go one small step further, you can really help to protect nature. And Michael Bell of Nature Learn and Birdwatch Ireland explained how.
You know, it's fine to just enjoy them, looking at them and enjoying them. But I do like to record things too, and it's really easy to do now. There's the National Biodiversity Data Centre, and they record absolutely everything all over the country. You can find them online. If you search for NBDC, you'll find their site. It's very easy to record anything at all. You just need to know what it is, where you saw it, and the date, and that's all you need. And then you can start recording what's in your garden, because it's very important for conservation to know what we have. You know, we don't know what to conserve if we don't know where things are. So you can record anything. You record mammals, you know, also birds, but insects, plants, whatever, through that website. Okay. So
maybe a photo is a good idea then, because if you're not sure what it is at the time,
you can submit
a
photo.
You can look it up.
Hopefully find out what it is, but also you can submit a photo with your site, and if you're not 100% sure. But yeah, if you are going to record things, you want to know what you're recording. You don't want to send in faulty information, whatever. The more you get into it, the more it gets kind of addictive. And, you know, in a garden like this, you'd record lots and lots of wildlife in here. Like I said, my garden at home, I've recorded 250 moths.
Presumably, Michael, from the point of view of pollination or...
They're very important.
They're just as important.
You know, we know bees are important, but moths are important, butterflies are important. And also, now, moths, there's so much diversity, and there's like about 1,500 species in Ireland, whereas you've got about 30-something species of butterflies. So they're a good indicator of what's going on in the environment. Some of them would be specialists. They might depend on just one particular plant for the caterpillars to feed on. Some of them are generalists. So for studying which ones are here, which ones are declining or increasing, you know, it can give you a good idea of what's going on in the environment around us.
So biodiversity recording, while it might sound complicated, is actually a really accessible thing due to new technologies. I met a local group who are learning about another tool that anyone can use to record biodiversity. We're going to hear about two different apps that were being considered, but first, Dr. Adam Smith talked to the group about the value of embracing the citizen science concept.
And many people would have heard the term naturalist before, and there are many famous examples of naturalists. Charles Darwin is obviously a very famous one. And what it comes down to is someone who observes and records nature. So you don't have to be an ecologist, you don't have to do it as your job, but you can be a naturalist in your free time, which is essentially what citizen scientists can be. One scientist, they can only go to so many places and watch so many things, but if you have 1,000 citizens, you can watch and see a lot more and record a lot more information. So SEEK is the name of the app. It's SEEK.
That's the one there, so we'll click that and install.
I would get SEEK for now. iNaturalist, when you're getting more consistent with it, I think. And you can link that.
SEEK by iNaturalist.
Yeah. Records no personal information. iNaturalist, you have you put in your email, you log in, you create an account. And so SEEK is much more designed for people who are not that interested in giving away their information.
And it's fairly light because it uses the internet.
Before they got started at all, the children speculated about the different kinds of species that might be living close by.
Foxes, birds,
bees,
wasps,
trees, flies,
butterflies, bees, birds, wasps,
cows,
butterflies, hedgehogs, oh yeah, rabbits,
worms,
ants, maybe badgers.
So I say we start walking a little bit and then we can start. Hawthorn, oak.
This is elm.
Elm.
Ambles.
So, might be a good moment to try one of our apps then. What is nice about Seek, but essentially how it works, this is a big camera button. It opens your camera. Yeah, it is pretty cool. So what Seek has, essentially, is it has a built-in AI, which is it's actually an image classifier or image recognition model, trained via iNaturalist, which is the biggest citizen science recording app in the world. And with something like 80,000 species in it, all you have to do is point the camera at what you're looking at, and it should give you a reasonable guess about what it is. You'll have to go quite close.
Yeah,
so there it's got a great horse tail. So once you have the species, then you can click the photo button. There you go. But like, here's a hogweed, and essentially just put the camera up to it and press the camera button to finish the recording. So, observed a new species, and then you can view some extra information. There will be pictures of the plant at the different stages. So here, they're not flowering yet. You can tell the scientific names, whether it's native or not. There's an about section which pulls that information from Wikipedia as well. There's some maps which show you the range that the species has been recorded with iNaturalist or with Seek. You're going to be drawn to interesting species, colorful species, but try to, for every one time you record something interesting, record something regular or normal, whether it's the dandelion or a nettle, because when this data is used and processed in the end, we need to know just as much about the common species as we do the rare ones, because, you know, with a changing climate and, you know, habitats shifting all the time, common species might not be so common in 10 years. And without knowing where they were and why, we won't know how to reverse or stop those declines. So that's really important as well. So I think for now, what our best thing to do is try and find some interesting things, some insects. We need to try and find some fungi. Let's see what else pops up.
What about the bridge?
Skaters on this bridge.
I think it would be good. Certainly a lot of mayflies about.
I took a photo and it's like walking over.
That's a dandelion there, so I'll have that recorded.
Okay.
Ribworked plantain.
It couldn't be clearer. This actually is child's play. So there are no excuses for the adults among us either. For the students, this was the perfect balance of technology and engaging with nature. Adam also emphasised how people that spend a lot of time outdoors can be really invaluable if they embrace this kind of citizen science. So if you know anyone who's a farmer, hunter or a fisherman, a hiker or outdoor sports enthusiast, or even a regular dog walker, you might encourage them to take a look at the Seek app and the biodiversityireland.ie website. It is really easy, and the evidence today seems to show that anyone can get hooked pretty quickly. Our recording group were off at a gallop.
It is a bluebell, but I'll tell you
it's
what.
It's very thin, though.
They look different.
Yeah, it's like one species of tree.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It just came up.
As it happens, having your Seek app at the ready might be a very useful thing as we turn to our next aspect of biodiversity.
So what we are going to look at today during our walk is one of the rarest native woodlands in Ireland, which is called the riparian woodland. Ripa comes from Latin and it means bank, so the river banks and also any kind of freshwater banks that we can have, they are kind of a border in between land and water, and they are very, very fragile and they're very important and very rare.
We did speak briefly about woodlands earlier, but ecologist and researcher Piero Cochises led us down by the edge of the Garavogue River so that we could marvel at the superpower of the trees that live along here.
So we're going to walk through and see all the species that we have here and their importance in the whole life cycles. So here we have a lot of broadleaf species, and we have some that move in first. We call them pioneer species. One of the most important is alder and willow. Now, alder is the one that we most frequently associate with riparian woodland because they live on the riverbank, and they're one of the very, very few trees that adapted to the water. So water disperses their seeds, and they have little cones, and the cones actually germinate while floating in the water. So when they land by, you know, somewhere else, they already are ready to just take down the roots and grow from there. So that is very unique to hear. What else? We also have a lot of fish in the water, salmonids, salmons, trouts, and the trees provide a lot of the food for these fish because we have a lot of invertebrates living in the trees. So for example, for brown trout, 90% of their diet comes from these invertebrates falling off the trees.
Insects, you mean?
Insects and like anything that can be worms and all that that you associate with trees. So different trees have different leaves, of course, and they break down at different speed. So for example, we have Prunus padus, which is the bird cherry. Their leaves can break down in water in like 2 weeks. An oak leaf can take up to months. So they provide food for longer. They can, you know, support different species. So it's all very complex. That's why we need so many different species, which is what we have here, which is great to see. Oak trees that we find here, they're called the climax trees because they're on the top of the well, it's not the food chain, but on the top of the system. And one oak tree can support up to 900 species. So these can be food for not just for the fish, of course, but then we have birds, we have mammals, we have squirrels, we have woodpeckers. So it is very important that we have diversity.
In fact, the students that I had spoken to earlier were instinctively tuned in to this underestimated tree power. They'd already suggested that trees were an important building block for encouraging diversity in nature.
Well, you cannot mow all your lawn to leave space for the bees. Yeah, so try not to cut down more trees.
If you cut down a tree, you should plant another one.
You could plant more trees.
Yeah, I think we need to do something about that, like planting more forests, looking towards the future. Trees help more oxygen. I think that helps the environment.
The amount of trees that's getting cut down and the amount of trees that's being burned.
And if you cut down a tree, just remember to replant it, because trees store loads of carbon.
Not cutting down as much trees, I guess.
And why are trees good for the environment?
Because of photosynthesis. They produce oxygen. They get our carbon dioxide and make it to oxygen. Hopefully we'll plant more trees and we can fight global warming.
So, taking their advice on board, we're heading back to the soon-to-be community orchard and woodland at Clebra.
What do you do in this situation?
We're basically just trying to point out what this woodland is trying to achieve on its own. Like oak canopy is nature's highest achievement in Ireland, I feel. So it's just trying to subtly show that in the context of the woodland that's here, which is a predominantly beech woodland dominating a regenerating Atlantic temperate rainforest. We're 10 miles here from the Atlantic, so it's an oceanic woodland on a limestone pavement, which if left to its own devices would be a really diverse native woodland.
Here are speakers from the Home Tree Charity, which works to restore native woodlands through community engagement. We're guiding members of that community on an assessment of their wooded area. There was a really wide group of interested people there, and the woods are home to the Children's Community Garden, the Sligo Woodland School and Sligo Letts Organic Farm. The idea of the gathering was to consider a management plan for the forest here and to lay the groundwork to establish a community orchard. Jeremy Turkington, who's in charge of Home Tree's seed bank, had led the group through the woods.
The history of Irish forestry, that this was planted as a beech forest in the 17th century as part of an Anglo-Irish domain, and it's trying to highlight the difference between that and what a native forest might look like. And then there's other issues to contend with, such as invasive species, rhododendron, laurel, Spanish bluebells. There's a lot to kind of weave in there. So it's just getting the discussion going with councils, community groups, who have all attended today and have all been really super engaged, which is fantastic to be a part of and see.
And tell me about that concept of the Atlantic rainforest.
Temperate Atlantic rainforest are long established woodlands. In Ireland, we have 1/5 of 1% of our woodland left is indigenous old growth, kind of virgin forest, and there's 20 million acres on the island of Ireland, so that's 1/5 of 1% of that is what would have been here since the last ice age, it's about 10,000 years ago. But we still have those tree species are still here, and they will regenerate if we encourage it, but we actively have caused the situation of their decline, but so we also actually have to be part of the management of their recovery. So yeah, I was just highlighting when we were up there, the little saplings growing on the woodland edge. I'm just really trying to foster a sense of urgency and ownership of, and give ideas of what can be done to encourage these plants to come on and not be outcompeted by a more dominant species.
There's an oak. Look, there's a little ash beside it. But that's a gem. That's what you want to have.
With all natural regeneration or restoring nature, we have to approach it on a river catchment scale. Like, that's the only way, on a landscape scale, but more importantly within river catchment. I think there's 48 river catchments in the whole island of Ireland. Okay. My job collecting seeds is I'm looking at each of these river catchments, and I'm trying to preserve the local genetic character of all our native tree species within these river catchments. Generally, the genetic character of trees, just like Atlantic salmon, sea trout, always follows rivers, freshwater pearl mussel as well. So we just have to begin to think of these problems and solutions on a river catchment scale. One example, this beetroot up here, the beech is the dominant species, is shading out native species, and so the ground is so compact and hard, the water is just gleaning off that and into the river. So you're already starting, you're influencing hydrology at the very, from the mountains basically. That's one example of impacts within a river catchment.
And actually, if we follow that water just a little further downstream, we arrive back to Piero, who's explaining how the hard-working trees on the riverbank at Dorley Park deal with all of this.
Absolutely. It's not just pre-filtering, it's not just physical filtering of silt and clay, as I mentioned.
And how do they do that? By holding on with their roots?
Yes, it's because we have the roots, the water that comes in, for example, after a heavy rain, the silt is kind of caught in between the roots because the water is slowed down. So the silt that would be carried from all that water, if you don't have any foliage, any grass, well, grass won't really stop them, but it's more than nothing, that would all just rush into the water while we have the roots catch this. Now, this only works if the elevation of the slope is less than 7 degrees, but still, even if we have kind of a steeper slope, it still helps to catch the water and the silt. Now, they also work as a sink for nitrates and phosphates. This is very important because especially phosphates can cause algae bloom. So if you have a runoff from animal manure or anything that can cause an algae bloom, then that algae bloom will use up all the oxygen in the river, killing everything in there. So if we have a riparian forest, even a 5 meter wide section can catch 90% of this. So it is very important that we have them. And for willow, which is such a fast growing tree, after 3 years, they're almost up to full catching ability, let's call it that. So it's very, very good that they grow very fast and they're very efficient, very, very quickly. So we should get them because they act like a sink. All their trees also have nodules on their roots. So they work together with bacteria and then they capture nitrogen from the air and they collect it in their root nodules. So that is a very good sink. So it's very important that we stop the eutrophication of the rivers.
We have concentrated quite a bit on trees today, and the devastation caused by Storm Éowyn was a recurring topic in many conversations. Our experts pointed out that the areas worst affected were those that contained monoculture of non-native species. However, although the diversity of native woodlands did prove more resilient to the worst effects, the strength of the storm meant that few wooded areas escaped unscathed. Up at Cleaver Woods, Jeremy did point to one glimmer of hope.
Yeah, we saw recent, I don't know if they'd be called casualties, the beech canopy shades a lot of light, so when these trees came down, they created these huge openings, we would call them ecological chimneys, where huge amounts of light are allowed in. Inherently, nature wants to become more complex. So it was, those were really nice examples of how already, almost into the summer, huge, the seed bank has just been kick-started, and we have witch elm, a rare native species, hawthorn, oak saplings are coming up there, just in these, and native wildflowers are just coming into these little areas that were cleared by the storm. And I think that was a really important thing for the members who are with us here today to see. We need to strive for simplicity more in our approach to this. A management plan, like, it was very clear for everyone there to see, this is how native biodiversity is restored. We don't have to do much. It's already trying. We just have to foster that little bit. We just have to think about the species and what's happening here with the light and the shade, and how we can positively impact on that as a community.
And maybe that also gives kind of a message of hope or positivity in a wider way when we're talking about adapting to climate change or biodiversity loss.
Yeah, a big thing we do at Hometree is getting people's hands in the soil and getting them to work. And by the end of the day, having something physical that they can see a change that they made. And yeah, that's what we're hoping to have here. We're giving them a small number of tasks, simple tasks that they can engage in. And in their, you know, backyard, they'll be able to see, positive change. And hopefully that will relieve some of the climate anxiety and bring more people into the community. We're not here to save the trees. The trees are here to save us. Like, this woodland is gonna serve this community. It's, you know, it gives it clean air, clean water. It gives it, you know, biodiversity for all the non-human species, like, we haven't even talked about that, but it also the well-being of every individual that spends time in that woodland, or the community that gets to enjoy the time in there as well. So that's really hopefully what people come away from understanding, is the kind of reciprocity of the relationship with the woodlands.
What better way to sum up how everything is interconnected? Communities and individuals, trees, rivers and wetlands, technology and nature. At the heart of it all is the knowledge that all of us have a role to play. Let's try to make it a positive one.